once. And I can't remember how it arose, but there were some complaints about me. And I got hauled up to the council, and I was banished to stand in the Rhodesian market. They wouldn't let me stand with either of the two partners in the gold book for 3 months. I had to stand out in what was in those days the Rhodesian copper market, which we didn't trade in. I had to stand right out there and try and see what was going on. The Blue Button's job was very complex. It wasn't just a question of running errands and finding people in the markets and that sort of thing. If you're going to be a potential trader, you had to learn to try and get a feel for the market, although you weren't actually trading in it. And you had to watch the price changes on the boards, and you had to sort of sense with the people what they were doing, you know. You felt sort of like a flair for it. You could sense sometimes whether a guy was a buyer or a seller, you know, and you'd change your price accordingly if you wanted to, you know. It was very much a flair business. And we had lots of blue buttons who came into the company at the time I was there as a blue button who lost their jobs, didn't have the flair. They didn't have any ability to have a feel for the market. And it would have been very dangerous in those days to making traders. It's quite all changed now. I mean, funny enough, trading is now a much more logical business. In those days it was illogical, and you had to learn the logic of the illogical, if you like. Just had to have a feeling that you wanted to either be short or long, or the market looked a bit better, or the market looked a bit easier. You could feel it. Something went through your sort of blood. You sort of thought, don't like the look of this market, and you lower your prices for no reason, or raise them for no reason. And you had to have that flair. If you couldn't develop it, then you couldn't trade it. You'd have lost money.
And did you stay on the gold book when you became authorised?
Quite a lot, yes. I was on the gold book for a long time, actually.
And how many of you were running that book?
I think then other people joined and came along, and I became a member a year or so later. I was the youngest member in the stock exchange at the time. He used to call me Shirley Temple of the Deep. I remember that, because I stood in the deep market, what was known as the deep market. And I think I looked very young. There were about, must have been six of us in it. It worked out as six in the end, because Gerald Lennon joined. He became a blue button on with Henry Marks on the other side of the gold market. I remember very clearly. And Jeff came. He's a bit younger than me. He went in the equity market. I don't think he stayed in the golds. He sort of Sydney King. In the equity market, basically, he's always been an equity jobber. And Gerald grew up in the gold market and became a gold authorised and eventually became a member in the gold book. And I was there for quite a long while. I can't remember the number of years, until, of course, the new stock exchange was then built.
So now we're talking about the early 1970s.
Trying to recall what happened, because there was a time. It's a funny thing, you see. It's a question of where, if you're in the right place at the right time in life very often. I had a lot of luck. Because I remember now, I was in the gold market, in the old house. And by that time, Simmons, who I think I mentioned to you before, was a young partner with the firm, a good trader, had gone off to open up a new market for us. He'd gone off into the old market, started the old market, which was way over the other side of the house. I just remember. That's what I was, by that time, a partner. I was like the junior partner. Because other people had left, and there was a partnership, may have been half a dozen partners, and I was the new junior partner, that's right. And Simmons, who's a tough trader, went on holiday, and suddenly Sidney Davis turned to me, there's nobody else, you'd have to go and run the oil market for 2 weeks. I knew absolutely nothing about oils. I'd never been over there before. I knew nothing about the oil market. Anyway, I went over there. I remember very well. There was a very big jobbing firm in the oil market. David Blackwell, actually, his name was. The firm of Blackwell & Co. And he was like the king of the oil market, as much as we were the king of the mining markets. He was the king of the oil market. They did occasionally bid an offer in the oil market as well. And I went over there that day, I remember, and I went home that evening. I lived in Brighton in those days. I used to commute from Brighton, and I went home, and I got a phone call. from Julius Strauss, who was the head of Strauss Turnbull in those days. And he said, what are Trinidad oil? I said, I haven't the slightest idea. I said, I don't even know that we deal in them. He said, I'm sure you deal in them. He said, what's the price? I said, I don't know. This is about 7 o'clock at night. Half past 7 at night. So he said, oh, well, he said, anyhow, I thought you ought to know, he said, having already tried to catch me by asking what they were. I didn't know we traded them. I was doing BP and Shell and, you know, I didn't know what the small book had. And he said, well, there's been a takeover bid for them. I said, oh, well, thank you for telling me. What's the bid? He said, £4.50 or something, £4. Before decimalisation, £4, whatever it was. So I said, oh, thank you very much, sir. I picked up the phone to the office manager who's still in the office. I said, do we deal in Trinidad oil? He said, yes. I said, well, would you mind telling me how we stand? He said, just a minute. And he went away and he came back on the phone and he said, we're short of 50,000. I said, Jesus Christ, what are we short at? He said, £3. That was a fortune in those days. Fortune, so I didn't know what to do. Well, no, it wasn't my fault. I didn't know who dealt the fucking things. Excuse me. So I picked up the phone to the senior partner. I said, by the way, I just thought you ought to know, we've had a rather bad day. He said, what's happened then? I said, there's been a takeover bid for Trinidad oil. I wish seemed to be short of 50,000 at £3. And there's a bid of £4 something for them. He said, well, what are you going to do about it? And, you know, so I said, well, I said, I should get up early in the morning and I should make quite sure that I run the book in Trinidad oil, and I should give the lad, the boy, whoever it is, running, give him all the rest of the stocks, because all the activity is going to be in that stock. I said, I know. And, you know, I was very much the junior partner. I mean, I wasn't the boss anyway. I was a bit concerned and nervous. Anyhow, I got up the next morning early and went in there. And I was short of this 50-odd thousand shares. And I remember David Blackwell opened the whole thing up by bidding just under the market, the bid price. But if it was £4 something, call it £4, and he bid £4, the same price as the bid. And I thought to myself, well, that can't be very, I think I'd better sell some, because we've had a bid of £4. It wasn't in the days where you had another, somebody else came in and overbid it, or, you know, it wasn't in those days. I mean, it was a bid. And it had to go to some sort of monopoly or something, whatever it was in those days. I thought, well, that seems ridiculous. So I sold him 10,000 across the market. And he bid it again, so I sold another 10,000. He did it about five times, and I think I sold another 50-odd thousand. So I was out of 100,000, that's right. And then he stopped. And everybody said, hello. It's this boy in the house, you know, David Blackwell, big David Blackwell. He shut him up. And he sort of got, it was like a grapevine. It sort of went around the house in for 5 minutes flat. And about an hour later, something came up on the tape saying that it was going to be referred, this thing. And they collapsed. And I did a huge business because I, you know, bought more back. And we finished up on the day making a small profit, having started off with about 50,000 down. I always remember it, but it got all around the house. Sort of, you know, it was Tony Lewis, sort of, you know, seen David Blackwell off, sort of thing. That happened to me twice in my life. I've been in the right place at the right time. And just had the courage to do what I thought was right.
Yes. What was the other occasion?
The other occasion was, well, shortly after that, this partner of ours, Sidney King, was a bloody difficult man. He was really, he was impossible. He made the other partner's lives impossible. I mean, I was just a junior, but he was an impossible man. Bombastic and domineering and a bully. He was a good jobber. Anyhow, he decided, he had an argument with the partners. I think that the argument actually was about, if you're interested, that we were moving office. We moved office to Draper's Gardens in those, it doesn't exist now. Draper's Gardens, and Sidney King's wife happened to be an interior decorator. And he persuaded the other partners that it must be a good thing to let his wife, you know, play on the decorations in the new office, you see. points they agreed to, and the bill came in, and it was worked out that he'd actually charged us about £7,000 for the light bulbs. It was ludicrous. There was a whole argument around about taking us for the cleaners, because it was his wife. That he eventually said, well, I'm going on my own. I'm leaving you boys, and I'm going on my own. And he started the firm of S.C. King & Co. I was then back in the mining market doing my own business. And there was a whole kerfuffle in the firm, and Sidney Davis said to me, well, there's nobody else, you'll have to go and take over the store book that he's been running. Which upset Sidney King, because he thought that when he left the firm, he was going to take his store book with him and start his own company, S.C. King & Co. And he stood where he had been standing all the time. And I moved over that next morning and stood 2 feet away from him. He said, you piss off for start. I said, no, I'm very sorry. He said, I'm running the Smith Brothers store book. The whole business, it was all went upstairs to the council, because you can't stand 2 feet away from a competitor, obviously. And there was a big inquiry in the council. The same morning, we all both went up there for arbitration, and counts came down and said, Mr. King, you'll have to go and stand over there. Which made for a lot of bad blood between myself and Sidney King, because he thought, I am the big I am in the store market, I know all about Burton's and all the others, which is true. I knew nothing about them whatsoever. I just took over the book. But it did make a lot of bad feeling between us. And also, I made a lot of friends, because a lot of the brokers took my side. They thought that he was out of order. And I got a lot of business. And I built a good business there in the store book, and Sidney King, in due course, went bust. And he joined Wed De Lacquer, who was now BZW. They took him on, but they had a store book. And I always remember once there was some Gussie announced a set of results. And there were disappointing results. And I don't think I had much of a position. But a broker came up to me and said, and gave me quite a substantial selling order in them. And to my great surprise, King, who, as I say, was definitely an enemy by that time of mine, because he'd gone through a rough time himself by going bust virtually and being taken over by another firm, and he started to bid for them openly in the market, which was very unusual in the equity market. And I stuffed him. Every time he opened his mouth, I stuffed him. And he then carried on bidding. So eventually he bid for stock without mentioning a quantity of price. So I'll sell you 10,000. Then he said, I'll buy 1,000. And I sat down. And that again absolutely went round the house. Of course, Gussie fell out of bed. They collapsed the next morning. And he got in trouble with the firm. Eventually they sacked him. He was just a bit too big for his boots, but it got round the second time that it happened, where taken on the big guys, and it come in our favour. Mm. And these things make a very big difference. You get a reputation, which is not always deserved. There's a lot of it's luck. It really is. And I had a third occasion, which was very exciting, actually. When then what happened was that I stayed in the store market for a number of years. I always remember there's some characters there. We had a huge selling order once. There used to be a man there called Brown. It was one of these 90-year-old whiz kids. He was a tiny little man. You know, they're not except for little men and cripples. I mean, he was literally about 4'6", this man, old man Brown. And he suddenly came over to me one morning. I was just standing in the store book, and he said, come and buy me a drink, my boy. And I said, thank you, sir. I walked across the road to somewhat one of the alleys here. Sat down and he said, now what are Woolworths? And they were 20 shillings, it was before decimalisation, they were about 20 shillings to threepence. And he said, right, he said, well, he said, I've got a very nice order for you. He said, I've got about, must have been about 10 million or 20 million to sell. Which in those days was a huge order. And he said, and you've got it, he said, you've got to start me off in £500,000. So I said, delighted or something, you see. So I took £500,000 from him, and he left me the balance of the business. And I thought, that's a super order, and I walked back to the market, and I still made the same price, because he left me 50,000 more, 20 and a penny halfpenny, and then 50,000 more, 20 and threepence, all left with me, you see. And I couldn't sell the bloody things. I couldn't find a buyer. And about a week later, it got to me. I realised there was another seller in the market, because my opposition firm, which was WED, their store book, I was very friendly with the guy. They were obviously sellers as well. You know, I actually got the feeling that there's no way I could sell these bloody shit. Whenever I, they were competing. I couldn't understand the other sellers. So I walked across to Michael Bennett, who was the partner. I was quite friendly with him. I said, Michael, are they my cards on the table? I said, have you got a seller of Woolworths? He said, yes. So I said, no. Well, I said, I've got one as well. I'll tell you who it is. I told him. He said, I've got the same seller. I said, that is it's not possible. He left me the business. Can't leave it with two people. Well, he bloody well had. And we collared this old guy, went out to see him. He was 90. I said, Mr. Brown, did you leave me the selling all the wars? He said, yes, I did. And I said, you left it with Michael Benz as well. He said, certainly. But I said, that's against the rules. I said, you can't do that. You can't leave it with two people. I said, I can do whatever I like at my age. So I said, well, I've got news for you. I said, in that case, I said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. I said, we're going to go joint. He said, you can't do that. I said, we are. I said, we're going to go joint. And we were joint for about 6 months. It was enormous. I can't remember the order. It was a man called Stevenson, who had been a chairman of Woolworths, the last of the money chairman of the Woolworths Group. He lived in Bermuda. And we went joint for a long time. We became very good friends afterwards. This guy was Michael Bennett, was Frank Bennett, the chap I told you about in the mining market, who looked for the shops. It was his son. Fortunately, he died as well. He's a good friend of mine, Michael Bennett. We became very good friends, and we went joint on this order, and we did it in the end. You know, after we didn't make any money out of it. He was far too cute for us. I mean, he was a nut. He was 90, and he'd come up to us once he accepted the fact that we were going to go joint, and he'd say, right, how are you doing? And I said, well, we sold a few this morning, sir. And then he said, right. We said, well, I'll leave you 200,000 to be sold at 20 and sixpence, whatever it was. And we'd find a buyer or two, and we'd go across to them, and I remember once saying to him, I'll take that stock. He said, no, I'm not seller. I said, just a minute. He said, you left me 200,000 at 20 and sixpence. I thought, I've sold them at sixpence, three farthings or sevenpence or something. And I'll take the stock. He said, oh, no, I'm not seller, he said. I'm very bullish on these things. But I said, just a minute. I said, you've got millions to sell. What are you talking about? He said, yes, my analysts tell me that they're doing very well, Walt. And I said, Mr. Brown, I said, you've got a huge selling order. You've left me firm stock to sell. No, he said, you must have misunderstood. He said, I'm not a seller. This guy, I mean, there's no way you could ever make money out of this man, because you couldn't make him shift. We found that we'd sold stock and we couldn't get it back from him. So we gave him a bit more, and he finished up actually dealing for almost nothing in the end. I think the whole 6 months this huge order took, which was one of the biggest orders I'd ever done in those days, don't think Michael and I made umpence out of it, nothing.
Mm. What was the advantage of going joint book?
Well, because it stops competing with each other. There's no point.
Yes. Were these arrangements fairly common, joint book?
Joint books were... They were quite legal. They had to be declared, though. They were quite common in some cases. Common is not the right word. They were not rare. They were not common, but they had to be declared at the stock exchange. It was the public knows that we were joint in Woolworths. There were some joints that were permanent. We didn't have any of those. Some firms did. Where there was a particularly difficult market or anything, that they'd go joint that was permanent, so they stopped competing each other and both losing money. And the stock exchange was a much more cosy place, and the jobbing system went through a very difficult period for a time. What happened was that I'd been in the store market for a number of years, and I quite liked it. I made a bit of money in the store market, but didn't make any fortunes. I did quite well. And the firm decided then that they wanted to expand our gold book and open up a third gold book, dealing in different types, all the mining houses. Separate them off, in other words, dealing with the Anglo-American and General Mining and Union Corporation. And as they decided, well, I was still a junior partner, but I was climbing up a little bit in the ranks, decided that somebody else could do the store book, and I would go over and start off this new mining finance book, which I did. And the jobbing system at that time was going through a very difficult patch. And we were making money, just. Some of the larger firms, I think, were very squeezed. I don't remember the circumstances why it happened. The stock exchange has always been like this. There's a pendulum that swings, you know. Mm. And some years brokers made money, and some years the jobbers made money.
Roughly when was this?
Well, it would be in the 70s.
Yeah.
And the firm put me upstairs. I was asked to go on a council, and I wouldn't go on. Because I thought that it would detract from making money. And I'm not a bureaucrat by instinct. Committees don't interest me at all. But I then was asked, the chairman in those days, I forget who it was, asked me if I'd sit on a committee which was looking at the whole question of the jobbers' profitability. And there were a number of circumstances. There were a number of things going on at the stock exchange which contributed to the jobbers' lack of profitability. And one of them was, of course, you see, contrary to popular knowledge, the jobber has very rarely ever known what's actually going on. The brokers do, because they're dealing with the clients. Any insider dealing that took place was on behalf of the brokers. The jobber wasn't in a position to know anything because he didn't know who the clients were. The jobbers were more and more frequently in those days, as business was gradually getting bigger, particularly in the equity market, was getting very much bigger. And what was happening was the jobbers were getting legged over every single time. And there was another set of circumstances that was taking place that was hurting us, particularly as a firm, and one or two other firms as well, was the fact that the Americans started to come to London in quite a major way. And because they were not subject to any rules, they opened up branch offices in London. All the major firms had branch offices in London. They went straight out to South Africa and made huge contacts in South Africa and used to trade directly with the South African brokers, South African market, and we knew nothing that was going on. We had no idea what was going on at all in our own stocks. And our gold shares, we knew what was going on. I mean, there's huge trade going on. Stock Exchange then gave us permission. All the firms, not just Smith Brothers, they gave all the mining firms permission to go across to South Africa, and they allowed us to make one contact. I mean, it's a ludicrous rule. It was a rule that the brokers imposed. The council had always been broker-dominated, always has been broker-dominated. And the brokers said, OK, well, Smith Brothers and other jobbing firms in the mining market can go to South Africa and you can make an alliance, an allegiance with one firm. Or you can go to New York and make an allegiance with a firm. You only have one correspondent in every centre. And this lasted for a bit. Then you could see what was happening. I mean, there was just the fact that our correspondent in South Africa was dealing with the American brokers as well. We know what the hell was going on in the markets. We were absolutely, you know, we were in danger of being seriously caught and losing our business. The business was just going outside the London Stock Exchange, that was the point. It was transacting directly between New York and South Africa. And so I went up on this committee and I went through all the circumstances and I described to them all. I said, this is a ludicrous situation. There's no way that we can keep our business. I said, if the stock exchange doesn't change its rules, I will take our company outside the stock exchange because I can't carry trading in the gold share book when I'm only seeing a quarter of the market. It's all going outside in the offices outside in the street. And this argument went on for a long time, and even I won the day in the end. And there was a big outcry about it. The brokers were up in arms and everything else, but I said, I'm going to deal with anybody I want to in the world, providing that they fall within the financial sector, you know, that they're financially viable. And I can't remember all the details of the way the argument went, but in the end, we won our day, and we started to trade with everybody directly. Of course, it involved a totally new settlement system because they were not members of the stock exchange. It was very complex, and it was a very difficult period for us. But we won it, and we kept our gold share market. And in fact, our gold share business improved even more, and the firm started to make quite a lot of money out of the golds. And then, I don't remember the timetable exactly, but the last thing that ever happened to me before I stopped trading was that I was called in by Greenwells, and I think Sidney Davis and Henry Marks were joint chairmen in those days. Anyhow, Greenwells called me in one morning. I was then the next below them in the hierarchy of the firm. I was sort of not quite the senior partner, but very nearly in those days. Anyhow, Greenwell, the senior partner of Greenwell, was a very, very nice man. Called me in, he said, I've got some business for your firm in Union Corporation. And he introduced me to a very large South African, an Afrikaner actually, called Dr. de Villiers, who was the chairman of General Mining. I never met him before. And he introduced me, we sat down, and I said, right, so what can I do to help? He said, well, he said, there's a bid on the table from Goldfields of South Africa for Union Corporation, which I knew. And he said, I don't want that to go through. So I said, right. He said, I don't want to take over Union Corporation myself, but I can't let the English win it, because there were opposing camps in South Africa, always have been, the Afrikaners and the English. So I want you to buy 29.9% of Union Corporation in the market, and I'll give you the entire handling of it. So I said, right. I said, what's the timetable? He said, I want you to buy that 29.9% within 15 days. He said, never case your favourite scotch if you can do it. I said, right. I said, what am I allowed to make out of it? He said, I'll leave that to you. So I said to him, well, I said, good labour doesn't come cheap, you know. I said, I shall make quite a lot of money out of this order. He said, that's all right, my boy. He was older, he was about 60, this guy. Maybe more. He's now actually, funny enough, he's in the South African government. He left it in mind. Anyhow, he said, get on with it. Well, I mean, I walked back and I sat down. I thought, I said, this is huge money. I mean, the stock stood at around about £8 a time. You're talking about a lot of money. You're talking about, $200-300 million or something. It's a huge amount of money. I walked back in the market and I didn't tell anybody about it. I told Sidney Davis, Henry Marks about it, obviously. I didn't tell anybody who was standing with me, because I had a couple of lads on the book, and I ran the book, and I had a number two and a number three on the book. I said, look, I've got some business in Union Corporation, and I'm going to be very occupied, so I'm going to split the rest of my book between you two guys, so that all the rest of the stocks you can handle. And I then went round the market to the other jobbers, who I knew very well. I mean, all quite friends. I mean, they were no enemies. I said, look, I have got some business Union Corporation. I said, I'm going to be a buyer. I said, I suggest that if you get any business or get any stock, you come and see me and I'll guarantee you a profit on it, whatever you buy. But I said, don't fight me, because you can't win. I've got a very large order. And by and large, they were all quite happy. They said, well, obviously they were, everybody's upset if they missed an order and I'd got it. They obviously didn't want to be happy about that, but they were all quite fine, except for one man who was with BZW, who was then still WED, a man called Tommy Anderson, who was a very arrogant jobber, and he didn't say anything, but what he actually did was to sell short against me. Every time I bid for stock, I pushed the price up and down like a yo-yo to sort of fool everybody and get, you know, I'd rush them all the way up, and then I'd, as soon as sellers started to appear, I'd then rush them all down again, and then I manipulated the market quite blatantly to get the stock. And he kept selling short against me, and eventually the senior partner, who's became a very good friend of mine, Dick Wilkins, you must have heard of him, he's dead now, he became a tremendously close friend of mine, came to see me and he said, look, he said, you've got to help us. He said, that idiot, Tommy Anderson, he didn't use those words, works for me, has absolutely got himself in a tangle over this Union Corporation order. I said, well, how much is he out? He said, he's sort of 200,000 or 300,000 or something, and he's this wrong. I said, okay. So I went to see my client, and I said, I've got to help another job in the market. Do you object? He said, no, if you think so, as long as I get my stock, I don't mind. So I helped Tommy Anderson out. I sold him, put his book straight for him. and he got moved after that, and I became very good friends with Dick Wilkins. Anyhow, we did this order. We made a lot of money out of it. I mean, in those days, I think we made a couple of million or something out of this order, a huge order. And we got it, we did it for them in 15 days, and they actually went over to, they went on, General Mines, to take over Union Corporation in the end, which they have since. I became very friendly with them as well in South Africa. It's done me quite a lot of good from a career point of view. But it was also a tremendous thing, that, again, in the firm. I just didn't be in the right place at the right time, because there was so much mystique about this order at the time, you know, inside the firm. They couldn't know what was going on. There was this huge volume of business going on. And in the end, the firm made what was in 1974 or something, you know, a fortune. It was a couple of million quid or something. And shortly after that, I became chairman, and I decided not to carry on trading, because it's not a job which you can do and then drop the book on the seat and go out and do something else. You know, if you're going to be an administrator, you've got to be an administrator. You can't be half. Same as if you're going to be a trader, you've got to be a trader. And so that was really the end of my jobbing career, really. I've been jobbing about 30 years.
Did you regret that?
I did at first, yes. I did miss the cut and thrust of it. I really did. I loved it. It was always a job which I found quite easy to do. It was a struggle. I had bad times. I had lots of times. I lost money. But I never felt I wasn't on top of it. I really missed it. I was not a very good administrator at first. I don't know that I've ever been a good administrator, quite honestly. And then what happened was I became chairman and just really decided to change the character of the company very much, because